Hello, I'm Greg Johnston, and welcome to Imagining the Past. This series of podcasts recalled from sessions held during the 2019 Historical Novel Society Australasia Conference, held at the Parramatta campus of Western Sydney University on the 26th and 27th of October, 2019. The podcasts were made from live microphone feeds. This session was titled Dispossession and Betrayal, Recovering the Erased History of First Nations, the Frontier Wars, Acts of Protection and Assimilation, and Kidnapping of the Stolen Generations are episodes in Australia's history which have been erased or minimised. Many Australians still remain ignorant, while official white accounts taught in our schools have yet to fully address such events. Indigenous writers Madison Shakespeare and Lisa Chaplin discuss with Maori author and academic Dr. Paula Morris why Aboriginal history has been suppressed, what is needed to remedy the omission, and how historical fiction can play a role in ensuring past injustices and cruelties aren't forgotten or repeated.
I've been chatting with Lisa, who publishes under various names. She's a very slippery character, and includes many Aboriginal characters in her books, including her romantic novels as well as her historical novels or her crime novels. But you have received pushback about that at various points throughout your career, and I wondered if we could begin by you talking about that.
Yeah, well, when I started writing, I actually started writing the exact same year that I was recognised as an Indigenous person. I was just at a Fijian friend's place for lunch. He was married to an Aboriginal guy. There were several of his mates there. And in the middle of conversation, Kevin looks at me and goes, "So what mob are you from?" And I looked at him, I said, "I'm not." And he said, Yeah, mate. You're Koori, 100%. And I went, okay. And he goes, "No, really." He said, "Where's the gap in your ancestry?" And I said, "I don't know who my grandfather was or is." And he goes, "Ha." And he said, "Where did he come from?" I said, "Well, my nan's family come from Braidwood. They were very upper to upper middle class. My great-grandfather was the mayor of Braidwood." And a few years later, I was doing an Aboriginal history course at UNE, and a lady from Braidwood actually showed me the proof that my great-grandfather, while the mayor of Braidwood, a year after my father's birth, passed a law throwing all the Aboriginal mobs out of Braidwood and passing a bylaw that they could not return. Now, considering they were all but free workers, this is quite extraordinary for the time. So starting to write that same year was quite amazing for me, that it was like such a natural progression. I'd grown up with Aboriginal people, never thought about it. They were just my mates. You know, I had Greek friends, I had Italian friends, I had Aboriginal friends, never once thought of the difference. But when I started writing, it was immediately I had an Aboriginal main character. And he was... because I'd done some research, he was illegally imprisoned, which I found that the Australian government routinely did from the 1920s right up until the 1980s, and gave fake death certificates to their relatives to make sure they didn't go looking, especially for the whiter children, so that they could be put into white society and forget that they had Aboriginal background. And that was my first novel. 9 years later, through New Zealand, I won an award, and that sold. I got hundreds of pieces of feedback saying, "This could never have happened. You're lying. You're making it all up." And yeah, that I got 2 pages of reasons why this book would never sell from a judge. An editor told me, "Never send me this book again. I never want to..." She'd been working with me for 2 years. She goes, "I never want to read this book again." So, yeah.
Just before we move on from that, that page of reasons from a judge, from a competition, some of the things included were contesting Aboriginal history, were they not?
Absolutely. It was actually a two-page racist rant that readers do not want to know where, what their ancestors may or may not have done. And you will never sell this because people will say it never happened. And hauntingly enough, in America, oh, wow, everybody loved it. It sold well. I got fantastic feedback. Australians, oh, my goodness. Yeah, I copped a lot of abuse.
And what's the name of the book?
Well, they called it Her Galahad. I called it Dark Knight to start with. But, yeah, apparently there was another book coming out with that title. Mm-hmm. And I didn't get any choice in what it would be called. But although it was published 18 years ago and my first book and terribly overwritten, very melodramatic, it still has value in that it was an actual truth. What happened to Jira, who was the main character, happened in real life to many characters, many real life people.
And that would be bad news for all of us at this conference, wouldn't it, if people were not interested in things that happened to people in the past. We would all kind of just have to pack up our bags and go. So Madison, you come at this from a different perspective. And also, Madison alarmingly has got quite a few notes written down, which makes me feel that she should really be the chair rather than me. But before we do anything, would you mind standing up and showing people this? Because it's...
I don't mind, but even before we do that, if I might be... And I mean this most humbly. We're on Darug land.
And I'm sorry, I'm too ignorant.
No, please. It's so exciting to be here. And we've got a timeline and we've got a time constraint. And I was here really early, running my companion dog up and down the hills most inelegantly. She did it beautifully. And it is exciting and we move with the moment. So it's not, and never is it a critique in terms of being remiss. Rather, it's difficult at times going back, looking back. But it's so important because this is Darug land. And what's really significant, and I am going to stand up, what's really significant is that it's meeting land. It's land that Windradyne walked across when he was walking down to the steps of the present Parramatta Town Hall. There he is. And... See if we have some technology things happen. Usually does. And I have got a smile on my face. I shouldn't have a smile on my face because when he was walking down, it was after his wife and his children had been massacred. His mob had been slaughtered, blood strewn across Bathurst fields. I'm going to give a disclaimer here because what I will speak about in terms of past events will be acts of genocide. In response to questions of pertinence in regard to contemporary matters. But most of his mob he saw decapitated. He saw their heads cut off, put in cauldrons, bodies dug up, skulls extracted, sent back to England. But having been through all of that, and imagine the PTSD. He was a peacekeeper. He thought and knew the only way for our culture and cultures to continue was to be a peacemaker. So he walked down here to the steps of the Parramatta, where the Parramatta Town Hall is. It's the first place that any legislation was drafted and indeed looked at being enacted to kidnap children. This land is pertinent land. Pemulwuy ran, fled, resistance warrior across here. And the building that's the humanities building at the moment in terms of the office, a relative of kin died in that building, less than 200 metres away from where we are. And it's pertinent, certainly traditionally speaking in terms of the old law, L-O-R-E, to say, ancestors, thank you. Your tenacity, your passion, your diplomacy, your wisdom has meant that we're all here today. And also, thanks for bearing with me because I'm wearing a cloak that is made of Baru dreaming, so crocodile dreaming, as well as the back of it. There's a stingray cut into the back of it. It's Wallaroom. This cloak was cut because I had a number of students enrolled in my units, Indigenous students, graduating for the first time, first person ever in their family to get a degree, ever. And some of these families, we had top football players, international football players, the most remarkable sports people, most remarkable accomplishments, and yet the proudest moments of grandparents' lives coming to graduation, their granddaughter or their grandson to graduate. So the cloak is really significant. It comes from, as I said, Stingray Dreaming from Henley in Adelaide. Me too. Only took 3 days, it was quick. Actually, it didn't take Windradyne that much longer to walk down here. Probably even through bushfires at the time, because a lot of spot fires arose because there was a lot of denuding of natural country. But as I said, it's never about redressing or berating or anything like that, or political correctness. It's about understanding context. Because through that, you spoke of collaborative work. Through that, through understanding context, through looking through other people's glasses, other people's perspectives, looking at other experiences, then we can have meaningful collaboration so that we can write texts that don't perpetrate discriminatory and discriminating stereotypes, that don't perpetuate acts that get enacted, would justify enacted legislation called genocide at international law levels. So we can move away from that, and not necessarily in a confrontational way, but I'll say this, in a user-friendly way, in a way that actually makes sense to others who haven't necessarily been through the same situations, who don't necessarily want to go through the same situations. It unpacks histories that haven't been taught. So, accordingly, I acknowledge our traditional owners.
Kia ora, thank you for that. And I'm thinking... I'm thinking also that we're all here today as writers, but we're also here today as citizens. Mm. And so we have our interest in our own national histories and our own local histories, our cultural histories, from those two points of view. And especially as I understand in Australia, you have to vote, don't you?
Yeah. Unless you're a conscientious objector.
And then it's $20. Yeah, I'm told. Oh, is it 50? It's
$50.
$50. So it's just a money-making scheme.
It's a disincentive,
yeah,
really,
basically.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
It's more for a parking ticket on campus.
I've seen the map of Australia that divides it into the different traditional countries. And the thing that, in fact, I think I first saw it when Anita Heiss, who some of you will know, came to talk in New Zealand. Because I lived for a long time away from the Southern Hemisphere, so this was all quite remote to me. And the thing that impressed and overwhelmed me was how many nations, how many cultures, how many stories, how many languages. And that is what absolutely lies beneath the whole of Australia, even if you're writing about something that happened subsequently or came afterwards. But this question of pushback against stories that are told makes me ask probably quite a stupid question for all of you. How much of this history is taught in schools to begin with? How much? No, is it?
I wasn't taught anything. Nothing at all. And that was even yesterday. They talked yesterday about what would happen, what would have happened had the French stayed on in Western Australia and the English there, and we would have been two nations on one continent. And my thought was, excuse me, it was already at least 300 nations. Mm-hmm. Australia is a continent. It's only been called a country in the last 200 years.
And this issue came up when I was at an Indigenous Writers Symposium in Banff in Canada, actually, because they said in Canada the discussion very much becomes about English and French, that these are the two cultures, the two languages, and they said that Indigenous languages get absolutely left behind. Mm-hmm. And they were, you know, felt very angry and disenfranchised. But in New Zealand, we just had the big debate going on for a long time, should New Zealand history be compulsory in schools? A bizarre question, I think, but it's one that finally we've made some headway on. Here in Australia, do you feel that that is still something that needs to happen or is beginning to happen?
Certainly, having had the the humbling responsibility and, well, yeah, humbling responsibility for the last 3 years of teaching many students who will be primary and or secondary teachers of the future. Retelling aspects of history, unpacking those histories, has been, it's been incredibly difficult. The disclaimer I mentioned a moment ago, that I mentioned not for token reasons, but for real reasons at the beginning of every lecture that I give. I do an acknowledgement, or depending upon where I am, if I'm in my country, Gadigal country, I do a welcome to country every lecture, not for token reasons. Everyone is different. Some of them go on for 45 minutes, but they do have content in them. And our stories, our yarns, the old way. What is interesting is that looking at the new teachers that are emerging, both at primary and secondary levels, there is this absolute just drive to retell. And it's really difficult because many students say it's really difficult because they don't identify as First Nations peoples. And they say, well, how can we legitimately represent? How can we tell about histories that and stories that are not our stories? How can we talk about language when we don't speak language? Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we had over 600 dialects before 1770, it's estimated. And we're lucky if we've got about five that are being taught in this state now. And that's really, really alarming. And yet I had an ex-student approach me, ring me 2 days ago, suddenly say to me, I've decided I'm going to learn to speak Dharawa. Fantastic. And I said, why? And he said, well, I've got a young student in year three and nobody can talk to him. I mean, he can't say much, but he wants to learn. And if he's going to learn, then I'm going to learn. Now, this is wonderful. So should we abandon history altogether? I'd be redundant.
I think everyone will be redundant in here.
Perhaps look at the different words, look at different ways of speaking them. Listen to other stories, look at whose history it is, and look and see what has been prioritised, and I'll use inverted commas, as knowledge. Have a look and see who has publishing rights. There was a most pertinent question asked in terms of publishing, and if I may just step to the side with that and draw reference to an elder, Larrakia elder, Billawarra Lee. Billawarra Lee had sat for many, many years on the National NAIDOC Committee. She's a senior elder. She's a remarkable woman. First ever Larrakia traditional owner appointed not just as elder on campus but as academic on campus at Charles Darwin University, and prior to that was at Flinders University in Darwin. Billawarra Lee wanted to publish a text. The way in which she did this was to self-publish. Now, that is not an easy thing to do, but she self-published because that was how she maintained not only copyright, which is so significant. As an academic, I can honestly say I fight every day for ownership over my photographs at this university, for sacred images, for images of my art, for the individual handmade each lecture slide that I make. Yes, with dots and circles. I like to be ironic at times. And Billawarra Lee, she published Healing from the Dilly Bag. If anybody hasn't seen it, please, it's remarkable. It's a remarkable text. Healing from the Dilly Bag. And she's been around the world to many, many Indigenous conferences and indeed First Nations meets, invited to discuss her text because it's the only way that she could actually maintain rights over her dreaming, because it was and is her dreaming, over her intellectual property in contemporary terms, and it's been incredibly successful. So perhaps it's not an option for all, but it is also another way, perhaps. If you face conundrums, if you face editors who are hostile, because you're right, people don't want to hear some of the inelegant truths.
Yeah. But surely if we're in the business of writing about history, as so many of us are, then the sanitised version of history, or the bowdlerised or the excised, is of no interest to
Well, you'll have child protection legislation quoted at you if you say that, and you say you want to teach it in primary and secondary school. You can't talk about this. How could I possibly be thought to be worthy to be in front of a mob of kids talking about massacres in the Bathurst Plains, let alone Waterloo Creek, let alone Tasmania? We're only going to call it Black War rather than Black Wars. And look, you know, did it really matter? It wasn't really civil war, was it? Wasn't just a little bit of resistance, and it wasn't genocide, although I can, and I will tell you this, I can, in my sorry day lecture, I can link it back to subsections of the International Acts in terms of genocide and its genocide. We ratified into the International Convention on Genocide in 1949. And we have been doing it, The government enacted legislation, state and federal, territory as well, levels, to perpetrate acts of kidnapping, stealing, displacing, abusing children after 1949.
Australia policy.
Indeed, and they are contrary, indeed, to international convention. So, you know, there will be resistance, but what do you do? Do you move forward with sanitised version? Here's a question. Do you want history to be accurate? I mean, are we making an assumption here? Sorry. Should we just call history fiction?
Well, we've been talking about that a lot, haven't we? The different versions of history.
And yet, as a writer, you've also got the conundrum that Madison and I talked about before, is that you're free to talk about your dead ancestor. We are not.
So, this raises issues to do, maybe to go to the collaboration question or the question that's come up in this conference about somebody wanting to write an Aboriginal character but not being First Nations themselves, and the many, many issues that need to be considered. So something I didn't realise, that's quite a difference between our cultures. Māoridom is a very boastful culture, and we're obsessed with naming our ancestors, right? That we like to name them, we like to say, and back and back and back and back to the first voyages and beyond that to the gods. That's an essential part of Māori culture, but it's quite different here. And to me, it seems, from an outside point of view, that there is a lot of protection of knowledge, the idea that some things are sacred, that some things can only be known and spoken about by certain people. We do have that to some extent in Māori culture
and
as
that's,
well.
That's really pertinent, particularly also places. And if it's not often spoken of, but certainly places. I mean, I had a student approach me on one occasion because in another faculty, she was almost failed because she refused to put a photograph of a particular learning ground because it was a burial site. I had to go to the dean of that faculty and say, with all due respect, she should be given an HD. So cultural protocol it's huge, and so often it's the ticker box tokenism, as I call it, and it's not, that doesn't help. So things like Google doesn't help. The internet doesn't help in so many ways because there's this expectation that we have a right to know everything.
This is exactly what we were talking about yesterday, wasn't it?
It's so accessible. However, you know, with initiation, for both women and men in different contexts, not everybody went through the same ceremonies. Not everybody was afforded the rights to know certain things and be engaged in certain practices. Just because you're old did not make you an elder. I say that most respectfully, and I do have a lot of critique on that.
Can I just ask, Lisa, when you're doing research for books, and can we talk about maybe Beneath the Skin, which is a recent book for you, with this issue of cultural protocols, was that something that you had to consider and negotiate?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. My publisher said they wanted to reach out to all the Koori papers and Māori, and I go into all of them. And I was asked, first off, do you identify as Aboriginal? I said, as far as I can, yes. Where is your proof? Madison and I talked about this at length, last week, week before?
Do you all know about this issue of proof? Is this familiar to you?
Basically, to prove that I am Aboriginal, when the White Australia policy was still in effect when I was born, and people were told to not. Even when I was identified and I started telling people I'm Aboriginal, don't tell people. What do you want to tell people that for?
Well, they may have had to apply the blood quotient.
Yeah.
Legislation.
Are you quarter?
I mean, which bit of
are you?
You well, that's right.
Like the old octoroon.
No, no.
You know, which is disgusting. Because nobody questions. Does anyone say to the Queen, and how much of Queen Victoria have you got in you?
But also, who's proof and why? Certainly back before James invaded or landed, simultaneously, really, we didn't have that issue. We go to a Bogon Moth Festival and say, well, where are you from, brother? No, I don't think so. I mean, who's proof?
Yeah. And that's the whole thing. When I got when I've been identified as it, Madison did the same again a couple of weeks ago. Yeah, definitely a Koori, mate.
So Matt, it's not my I need to say this. It's not for me to decide. It's not my business. No. Traditionally speaking, it's not my business.
And it is what it is, and you don't need documentation. But the Australian government demands it. My daughter applies for jobs. She cannot. Yeah. She cannot identify as Koori for the Australian government jobs without correct documentation, which my family does not have, because my grandmother wrote father unknown on the birth certificate. So,
which, by the way, I've said father unknown is a fantastic title, don't you think? I think she should
write
that book.
It's a great title.
Yeah. But the trouble is I can't write about my grandfather if he's dead. Well, I can...
Yeah.
Yeah. It's...
It's complex. And...
Yeah, bit of a minefield.
That's... the best way of looking at it. In those circumstances, if you're wanting to, and you're worried that you might be stepping on cultural protocols or not addressing perhaps as fully as you should, students will say to me, well, what do? We're not Indigenous, how do we teach this? Similar sort of conundrum. In the past, many lecturers have told them to go to land councils and seek advice. I say keep politics and money out of it. Doesn't get me a lot of friends, but it's honest. Some land councils are fantastic, others are not. I'm sorry. Money is not a concept that is a traditional concept. It is not a concept and a practice and a commodity. It is not a thing that relates to old LORE, certainly cultural spiritual law. So let's keep all of that out. Yes, you need to collaborate. You need to be guided by those, and it's really hard to find. How are you going to find people who, in a certain area, are going to have the knowledges, who are going to be the right, inverted commas, the right people to collaborate with?
And even if they are the right people, will they answer you if you talk to them?
And do you have a right to record what they say, with all due respect, and I mean that most humbly?
Well, this is my question then for Lisa, and for you too, Madison. So you say you can't write about your grandfather because he's dead. Now, Madison's saying there are ways around this, but that's your first thought. But then what about people who are writing about other people's grandfathers without even thinking that'll be an issue?
It's a culture. It's more of a culture. So you don't want to offend people. Ali, who was speaking here yesterday, was talking about Joan of Arc. Mm-hmm. And the people that came back at him and didn't like that he had put certain scenes in it and didn't like this and that. It's cultural appropriation is what historians do, what historical fiction writers do. We have to appropriate.
We write about the dead.
Yeah. It's like, in workshops, I tell the story of Harper Lee. Mm-hmm. She sold 60 million copies of To Kill a Mockingbird and her friends and family never spoke to her again, because that was the price she had to pay for putting them up for international ridicule. I don't want to... I've trodden on enough toes, you've got no idea. Every time I release a book with Aboriginal characters, I cop the same thing. And I try to keep it as... I've never had backlash from Aboriginal people. From the mobs, never.
Do you think you would have... can I ask you a question? Do you think you would have if you'd identified more strongly?
I would have what? Copped more backlash.
From the mob. There's a contentious question.
I don't know. I told my publisher, went back to them and
said,
should I
identify? And can I ask that because I identify? Sorry, I just want to put that out there. I'm going to ask the questions, yeah.
I've got no idea because they refused to read the books because I didn't... I said I identified, but... Oh, yeah, well, which mob are you from? I don't know. One of the three in Braidwood, Madison tells me. I don't know.
Possibly.
Yeah.
And there are ways to unpack it. There are ways to...
And she's helping me.
Can I just say, I want to have audience questions. So we're going to have a microphone for questions, just while you're thinking, if you want to raise your hand. But one thing I just want to say before we go to questions, one point Anita Heiss made to me very strongly, and this is something that many of you may be thinking about or already doing, is that she wanted to write Aboriginal characters in her books, First Nation characters, who just did things like fall in love and go shopping. And she said they didn't always have to bear the weight of symbolism. They could just actually be individuals going about their business. I mean, your feelings about this, Lisa?
That's something I've done right from the start. That's partly why I chose... Well, I chose the romance form because an agent in Sydney told me that I needed editing discipline and romance novels are the best editing discipline in the world. Apparently I rabbited on too much. Shocker. And I got published with an Aboriginal novel because I published to New York. I sold straight to New York and it sold in 26 countries. I'm pretty lucky that way. But I wrote about characters who lived, loved, made mistakes, did stupid things because, as I was saying to Paula before, I hate the word race. We are a human race. If we were not one human race, we could not breed with each other. We have different cultures. We do not have a different race.
But the most specific thing particularly, and this is a huge generalisation, I do put this disclaimer in at the beginning, it's a huge generalisation, but when looking, and look, we've all, I'm assuming we've all got capacity in this room, so you choose to do what you choose to do, and you take responsibility for those actions. When looking at Indigenous characters and what makes a character, if you're creating a character, a fictitious character who is an Indigenous person, connection to country, it speaks so loudly. It's more pertinent almost today than it was over 100,000 years ago. Particularly when we look at the strife this world is in. It's about being custodians of country, whether we're Indigenous or we're not Indigenous. That is a common message. So if you do want integrity in terms of aspects of characterisation with your character or characters, I urge you to look at custodians of country rather than owners. And that, as I said, you have so much responsibility and so much power and so much... this is exciting.
But it's getting it right and that makes people nervous. That's why I've only ever used fictional people.
But being nervous is great.
Who don't know their country. Like a lot of them have the same thing that I do, that I don't know where I'm from.
And that is a really common situation because of the extensive displacement.
Questions. Up here. Just wait for the microphone
because
we're being recorded.
Hi. I've just recently returned to high school teaching after many years out doing other things with books and young people. And certainly Aboriginal perspectives is mandated in the New South Wales curriculum, K-12. My school is currently going to be moving from a 7-10 high school to a 7-12 high school. So we're in the exciting position of being able to write new senior curriculum within constraints. And I've been encouraging my colleagues in the English faculty to look at including Aboriginal literature in that, particularly for year 11, where it's a bit more open. And I am getting the response from them that, Madison, you mentioned earlier, in that as white teachers who, to be frank, haven't really been engaged in learning very deeply about Aboriginal issues and literature and context, understand and agree with my position, but they don't want to do it because they don't feel they would have the knowledge or authority. Here,
and that's a national, issue. So I am in the midst of writing some programs.
Fantastic. That's what I'm saying.
They rebranded themselves. You know who I mean. National authority, people you actually have to do continuing education through, to show for teacher certification. Yes, all the way from early stage one right up to year 12. I'm looking at basically writing programs that will be accredited, and that way, ongoing, integrity-based, great information. I'm upselling here, but it's true.
And
providing, basically scaffolding and facilitating ways in which all teachers can actually go in and thoroughly engage and feel confident and not so nervous. The mindfulness is... It's rewarding, it's fulfilling, it's fantastic to hear. And that's what I was saying to wonderful volunteers outside. You know, there is so much of a propensity. I've had so many people say they're in another session this morning, but they wanted to come to this one as well. This is fantastic. This is where it starts. You will have readers. You will have readers.
And I also want to say that we can't have a writer's opting out because they're afraid to do things. As someone said to me once, as she was writing a book, set in Gisborne on the east coast of New Zealand, which is a very Maori city. Mm. She was writing a book set in a hospital, which is going to have Maori people in it. Mm. She had no Maori characters, and she said, well, I can't because I'll get criticism. Mm. And that's not a good place to begin.
That's ridiculous.
I guess my question actually is, how much damage can we do by getting it wrong?
How much damage can you do by not doing it at all?
Ali yesterday said, for for every story of Joan of Arc, there are dozens more with a different perspective. Every one of you here probably writes about a different culture. You write about people who don't belong to you. You have these things that happen. You try your best to write it respectfully, although, that said, there are the so-called shock jocks that will... As Lisa knows from a couple of years ago, someone on a panel tried to say Aboriginals were cannibals. Yeah, and I had to...
Have they been invited back to this conference or not?
No, I had to very, very respectfully say, and who were your three sources? Oh, they were the survivors, right. You know, trying to make themselves look good, I see. They didn't kill the people. But the thing is, if you do it respectfully, doing your research and respectfully, and then speak to the descendants involved. Mm. A lot of them, it's the age of the internet.
This is about, as writers, making the imaginative leap, isn't it? If we have to be able to make the imaginative leap into people who are not us.
Yeah.
However, often people fail at that, and that's why they get afraid. They're not doing a proper job because they're not able to think of a profoundly alien point of view.
Well, to be, who was it, Mandawai Yunupingu said, to be Aboriginal is to be political. I don't agree. I don't think that we are, and I think it's sticking people in a box. It makes people scared that there will be political or cultural backlash.
Being a First Nation person, like hopefully most other people, is about being human and humanitarian. And if you are creating characters and you are worried, then go back to empathy and go back to contextual experiences. Look at that yardstick. Yes, perhaps you haven't had the experiences that happened at those locations that you're writing about. Go to the land. Go to the traditional areas. Go to the traditional language. Find out who your traditional owners are. Work out who came, who frequented the land. If it's during a certain time period, look at context. And that way, there's integrity in terms of situational integrity, in terms of perspective. Yes, you haven't lived it, but you're empathetic enough and you're creative enough to do it real justice.
I hope you've enjoyed this discussion. If you would like to know more about the Historical Novel Society Australasia and our numerous activities to promote reading and writing historical fiction, please visit our website, www.hnsa.org.au. www.thetruthcast.au. There you'll also find full biographies of our podcast participants under the tab News and Interviews. I'm Greg Johnston, and thank you for listening to this podcast.